Coming up next is the Professor James McCanney Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening. This is October 19th, 2006, and a tremendous amount of material to cover tonight. I'm going to take a little bit different twist on doing this show than in previous shows. There is actually so little going on in the world of science today that it does not even deserve commentary. So I'm going to get right into the heart of the matter, the conversation I want to have tonight, dealing with simplicity, something that many times we lose sight of in everyday life, that we are running down this road as a society on a crash course to disaster. I was talking with someone just the other day who was, and I hear this all the time, people are like, can you believe every day all these people on the highway driving back and forth to work? And who invented this 40-hour work week where everybody has to go to work at exactly the same time at 8 in the morning and get off at 5, and as a result, we all sit in long lines in the cars. And I must say that I really don't become that involved in that myself, but I am shocked and amazed that the people continue to do this and think that this is somehow, this is the way to be, and then their children and their parents have done this, they're doing it. They march off to war and expect all future generations to do it because they did. The whole idea of living society in the future as we have in the past just because that's the way things are done, and translated into the scientific world, the idea that I want to present is that science becomes a Tower of Babel. And of course, many people have heard of that, but I want to twist it around and say, what should science be like? What really should science be doing? And it turns out that simplicity, many times, is the answer to many of the scientific dilemmas that we see in the modern world today. If you take political situations, I'm not going to talk about politics, but if you take world situations, many of them become so convoluted and complex that even the people that are behind the scenes can't understand them, so-called experts. And many times the solutions are extremely simple. And, too many times people have their egos in play, or the egos of their nation, national egos. And this is what is the downfall of mankind, because they just can't seem to get their act together and to solve the problems with simplicity. And this is the case in science. Now, science has had 100 years of what we call modern science, modern physics, chemistry, biology, geology, you name it, planetary exploration in the latter part of the last century and into this century. And as things have marched forward and become more and more complicated, more and more involved, more and more people, more and more compartmentalization, things have become more and more complicated. And that is understandable, but at a certain point, collectively, the scientific industry, as I call it, should step back and say, we've been trying to get fusion going here for, close to 50 years now? The quest to crack the atom and make a controllable fusion reaction has been going on for the better part of half of a century, and still no real progress. Nothing that you can write home about and say, gee, within a couple of years we're going to have a reactor online that'll actually take hydrogen and create all the energy we need. We just have to break down a little bit of water into hydrogen and through nuclear processes control that hydrogen reaction and end up with clean energy. So, but there is a solution to that, but it's a very simple one. So anyway, tonight I want to talk about the simplicity in science, and I'm going to go through somewhat of a litany of scientific topics. I'll start out with the axioms of astronomy, and many people are familiar with those, my conversations dealing with these, and then I'll branch into other areas of astrophysics and space science, talking about the lack of simplicity and the problems that it brings in the scientific community when scientists their theories become so complicated that not even they can understand them. A good example, this came across my desk this week, that Stephen Hawking is doing a movie. Of course, he was the physicist renowned for work on the Big Bang. It is said that Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, which was written in around 1988, has sold over 40 million copies, or 10 million copies in 40 different languages worldwide since it was first printed. But the interesting comment is that people say that his book is so difficult to read that most people don't get even through the first chapter. And this is what I'm talking about. The universe is not that complicated. The universe is very simple, and it's something that everybody can understand. So when I see scientists going off into really never-never land, my view is that they've created the Tower of Babel all over again, and it has gotten so complicated that the average person cannot understand it. But anyway, in this movie that they're going to make about the Big Bang, it's just beginning to be produced. It's interesting to note that they needed so much computing power that they asked the National Center for Supercomputing Applications to help out, and also NASA, to help out with the production of this movie. Which sure would be nice if I could get a national agency to help me with my show. But anyway, it's certainly in NASA's best interest to promote the Big Bang, because obviously a lot of political maneuvering went in to the 2006 Nobel Prize awarded to NASA, as I've talked about before, in a somewhat complaining manner, that an agency, anyway, I'm not going to go into that tonight, but the point is, when things become too complicated, I sit back and I go, you know, it's gotten out of control, something isn't making sense, and then when you point out contradictions in this extremely complex structure that scientists have made, very simple contradictions, then, for example, quasars supposedly have flown out the farthest, the fastest from the Big Bang. They have the highest redshift. And so you are left with a quandary. How could the heaviest things from an explosion fly out the fastest? Because in any type of explosion that we're used to looking at, the smallest things fly out the fastest and the big things remain near the source of the explosion. So to accommodate this, scientists dealing with the Big Bang say that, oh, well, all of physics reversed for 3 seconds, the first 3 seconds. And then after that, everything went back to normal. Modern physics, the way we know it happened. But they have to interject these off-the-cuff explanations which have no basis in reality other than it's needed to explain the contradictions that are brought up by the theoretical structure that's been developed. But at any rate, that's just an example of how complicated science has gotten. So without dwelling on that, I want to get to the concept of simplicity in science. And as I go through these various topics, I want to talk about where modern science is, modern astrophysics, space science, astronomy, and then I want to talk about what I've developed in terms of the theories that explain the same visual data, the same phenomenon, for example, the origin of the universe or comets or gravity and the workings of the solar system, celestial mechanics. All of these are very complicated topics, but the solutions are simple. And I have yet to hear anybody pick up my books and say, I could only read the first chapter. I couldn't get beyond that. And these books have gone out to kids, grandmas, grandpas, housewives that have no scientific background. And I have yet to hear someone say to me, this is too complicated for me, I just couldn't read it. And I think that's a compliment not only to my work, but to my understanding that people can understand science. It can be presented to the average person. There are many everyday examples of how the solar system works and the universe. And in the Big Bang Theory, now they're talking about 11 dimensions required to explain it. In my book, that's absolutely ridiculous because the universe is extremely simple. It's three-dimensional, and we can measure and understand it with, in a sense, the fourth dimension being time, but Newton dealt with time. So it's really not a fourth dimension of space. It is a factor that we deal with. Things happen before, things happen now, and things happen in the future, and thus we've developed this concept called time. But I also want to mention that in my development of orbital dynamics, I developed a very interesting mathematical technique where you develop the equations of motion, and in the technique, time drops out of the equations. And what's very interesting about this is that you get the orbital path for all time. And you can see where the stars have been, where they are going, and where they are right now in the equations when you graph them out. And I used this technique in one of my papers on galaxies published in astrophysics journals back in the early 1980s. But there are other ways to deal with this issue we call time. And there again, simplicity is the key, trying to find a way to deal with this. And if anybody has my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, look in the back. The very first paper is the galaxy paper, the continuing galactic formation paper. And look at the final equation in there. Time drops out of it. And the graph of the orbits of stars in the galaxies is given for all time. And so it's very interesting, a little mathematical manipulation there. And time drops out of the equation. So it's just a way of simplifying the way you present information. So with that in mind, I'm going to start with this somewhat of a laundry list of topics and talk about the simplicity versus the complex. And when I talk about simplicity, I'll be talking about my own concepts. When I'm talking about complexity and a lack of understanding or lack of the ability to present this to the average person, I'm talking about modern, what we would call standard astrophysics or astronomy or space science theory. So let's take a topic that we can all relate to, gravity. We're all held to this Earth by gravity. Our moon revolves around the Earth. In Earth's gravitational field, we're attracted to the moon, and the moon is attracted to us with the force of gravity. So gravity is something we're fairly familiar with. Anytime we watch a sporting event, whether it's gymnastics, whether it's baseball or football or basketball, gravity is the main contributor that makes it work. Can you imagine basketball without gravity? It would be hard to make a basket because the ball would just keep going up and up and up. That's the fact that ball will go up and come back down that allows you to make a basket or hit a home run or throw a touchdown in football. So we're all very familiar with that arcing motion of something being thrown with gravity. But something we did not really deal with on Earth, whether we're playing sports or whether we're working in a laboratory making measurements, is the thing that's not always apparent is electricity. And that's why From the very earliest days of Newtonian physics, Newton dealt with gravity, and then here's the extension into three-dimensional outer space applications, where gravity really seems to explain things quite well out there. There's some anomalous activity. For example, some of the spacecraft that are heading out of the solar system for the first time, the Pioneer and the two Voyagers, they're not exactly where they're supposed to be. And so there's an anomaly in the position of those spacecraft. Once again, there's a simple explanation for that. But back to just regular old gravity, the moon going around Earth in its orbit, the moons of Jupiter or the moons of Saturn in their respective orbits around those small stars. I don't call Jupiter and planet, I don't call Saturn and Jupiter planets. I call them stars because that's literally what they are. They're small unlit stars. But be that as it may, they both have moon systems, or one might call them planetary systems, revolving around them. But at any rate, so when you make the calculations using Newton's law of gravity, the 1 over r squared rule, the motion of the planets work quite well. It's just some of these intruders like comets that just don't happen to obey the laws of gravity. Excuse me, and astrophysicists and space scientists and astronomers have found excuses for this, one of them being the motion of comets do not follow gravitational laws, and even the ancients knew this. They called them the lawless ones. Comets were called the lawless ones for many reasons, because they could be very violent, they could do a lot of damage to Earth, and also they did not follow the normal orbits of the planets. So at any rate, comets were not obeying the rules. Now, it turns out that comets are in more elliptical orbits than the planets, and when they discharge the solar capacitor, even a small comet can discharge the solar capacitor to a much greater extent than a big planet like Earth or Jupiter. So the point is that electrically, things can happen in outer space that don't always fit the normal patterns. And that's one thing I learned early in my career in dealing with electricity in outer space, is that there are certain conditions under which electrical phenomena exhibit themselves, and then other conditions where they're almost devoid or completely missing. Let's take another example, where the Earth moves through the August return current sheet. Typically, when we have solar wind moving around Earth, it's in a nice flow pattern, but there's a tremendous amount of energy flowing by Earth. If something starts whipping around out there or causing the solar wind to quickly change, whether it's the pressure of the wind or the velocity of the wind or the magnetic field that's trapped in the solar wind, if any of those things change rapidly, that's translated through our protective magnetic shield, and all of a sudden that starts affecting Earth weather. So it isn't always the amount of electrical energy that's around, it's the change in electrical energy that causes the electricity to manifest itself. So that's why many times the electrical conditions in the solar system go unnoticed, because they don't manifest themselves, we don't notice them at Earth. I find it quite humorous that the American Geophysical Union meetings that are occurring all of the time, the list of topics, you wouldn't believe. You would think they were titles out of my weather book, titles of chapters out of my weather book, and that's literally what they are, as scientists start to discover the connection between the troposphere and the ionosphere and the ionosphere in the five-layer magnetic field. All of these, going back in my writings over a decade, specifically with these topics, and then right now these are being so-called discovered. There are even people winning awards for printing my material in journals. It's quite a heyday they're having, but at any rate, the point is that they still don't understand the root cause, and they can't really talk about it because they would have to admit that the solar system is truly electric. They would have to admit that the core of the sun is not the source of fusion. There's all kinds of basic theoretical models that would have to go by the wayside that are simply too sacrosanct, as they say, or religiously held beliefs of the astronomy community would have to go by the wayside. So piece by piece, they're trying to borrow my material, but not really quite give the whole story. And if they do that, it's kind of like the, if you have a pet dog and he's outside, he's an outside dog, he can't come in the house and it's a cold day, you know, he comes and he lays in the door. And then puts one paw in. And if nobody says anything, then he puts another paw in. And then before you know it, his head is on the kitchen floor. And then pretty soon, the dog's in the kitchen, laying on the floor. And that's what modern astronomers are doing with my theoretical work, trying to inch by inch grab it and assimilate it into modern astrophysics theory. But I think it's quite comical. I talked about students and how do you study, how do you develop creativity, and how do you study in a world where science is dominated by incorrect theories. So I find it amazing that the textbooks are going to catch up maybe 10 to 20 years down the road. So they're still teaching a very core set of incorrect concepts in the scientific world, coming from the scientific world in colleges and universities and even grad schools. When you pick up a textbook, they still don't have the real core issues. They're still dealing with theories that were outdated 20 years ago. So anyway, I'm dwelling a little bit on this idea of gravity versus electrical and gravity in the solar system because it's a very fine division. And there's people out there who are trying to copy my work, and they say, "Oh, everything is caused by electricity," and that's not the case either. There's a real fine line of what is noticeable, what's measurable, and what is not noticeable regarding electricity in the solar system. And that's why one needs a good scientific background, a good background in physics. And I find that people who, even friends of mine and acquaintances and even students of mine who have studied for years still make basic fundamental errors when talking about my work. And I'm misquoted a lot of times. That's why I do not allow any of my work to be posted anyplace else, because then it gets reposted and too many people think they know what I'm talking about, but when they go to write it, about it or talk about it, they simply do not have a clue. They make a lot of mistakes. And it's, so that's why I don't have any interpreters. That's why I don't have any email lists. That's why I don't have any, distribution centers. I don't have anybody writing books about me or my work because it's just too complicated and I don't have time to follow people around to keep correcting them. So the point is that electricity in the solar system is very subtle. The way it acts is very subtle. So comets, dirty snowballs. The dirty snowball concept might be one of the simpler ideas that has come out of modern astrophysics. But remember that the idea of an ice ball out in space forming a comet actually comes from Kepler. When Kepler first took the information and learned, and he took positional readings on the, took Tycho Brahe's positional readings on the position of objects and developed his equations, he realized that comets were not in our atmosphere as taught in by Aristotle. Aristotle taught that comets were a fire in our atmosphere. And Kepler said, no, they're way out there. They're out there amongst the planets. And Kepler could calculate their orbits. So he knew that there was a little bit more complicated situation with comets. So he, at that time, said, you know, they must be because they have this tail pointing away from the sun. It must be a chunk of ice coming in from outer space and melting as it gets near the warm sun. And that's where the dirty snowball, the ice ball comet model, whatever you want to call it, that's where the original core idea came from Kepler himself back in the Middle Ages. And so it was a simple idea, but as more data was accumulated regarding comets, the more complicated the explanations had to become to account for this strange data. And then during the course of this, a lot of the data was thrown away or just simply ignored because it didn't fit in with the dirty snowball comet model, up to and including the pictures of comet nuclei and other types of direct measurements at comet nuclei that show that there's no water at all on a comet nucleus or under the surface, and there's certainly nothing coming off the nucleus to form a tail. So, once again, the simple idea that a comet might be a dirty snowball or an ice ball in space became extremely complex, convoluted, and now astronomers are set with the problem that it doesn't explain the most rudimentary data, that would be a picture of the nucleus. There's no water, there's no snow, there's no ice on the comet nucleus. We have looked at many comet nuclei up close, not a trace of water or ice of any kind. And with the Deep Impact probe where it blasted a hole into the surface of a comet nucleus at Temple 1, Comet Temple 1, still no water. So where's the simplicity? The simplicity is that, and this is what I'm talking about, the complexity of scientific theories as it becomes more and more complex, and then all of a sudden the contradictions come in. There is so much work, so much invested time in these theories, the standard theories, that people will not back away from them no matter what. Let's talk about the Big Bang just a little bit. This idea that the entire universe started in one massive explosion, kind of out of one spot, and all the matter in the universe was contained there. You know, it's really a stretch of the imagination. And, you know, one thing I wanted to comment about this movie that Hawkins is making, and I find it rather bizarre, is they're talking about doing mock interviews with Einstein and Richard Feynman and other scientists who are dead. So would that be putting words in their mouths to make it look like they, in fact, support the Big Bang theory? The point is that a movie like that it's going to be made to influence the public, the general public, and to think that, wow, this is a tremendous theory and now I can understand it because I watched this movie. But in reality, the complex nature of the theories behind this have many holes and contradictions, and the movie will never, ever talk about these contradictions and inconsistencies in the theory. But it'll give me quite a bit of information and quite a bit of basis for talking about the Big Bang and why it's not true on this radio show and other mediums for getting my information out. So what really happened, and what's the problem with the Big Bang? There again, it's very simple. The data that's been collected by many astronomers, a growing group of astronomers, starting with Halton Arp, an astronomer who's quite elderly at this point. I believe he's still alive, living out of the country. But I communicated with him back in the early 80s when I was doing my work. And he had pictures of quasars associated with galaxies that were in the same local area of outer space, out in intergalactic space. The thing that I provided was the theoretical structure, the induced electric dipole redshift, which is somewhat complicated and subtle, but when you learn that this is the way electric fields work, it is not so complicated, and it turns out that the gravitational anomalies of the Pioneer spacecraft and the Voyager spacecraft, etc., those anomalous motions of those spacecraft, that they are not quite where they should be, can be explained by a very similar property based on the electric field of the Sun. Now, that is very interesting. Also, they went by Jupiter and Saturn. There were very definite telltale signs of induced electric dipole forces around those planets as the spacecraft came by moons, especially the small moons that were circling Jupiter and Saturn. So at any rate, there are simple explanations, but the problem with the Big Bang is that there is so much invested time and ego behind these theories that wouldn't it be too big a pill to swallow for these scientists to admit, you know, there's nothing to this, there was a simple explanation, we kept overlooking it for decades, and we're just going to pack up and go home, especially after Nobel Prize was awarded, especially after movies are made and a lot of fanfare in the press. It's just simply too big an issue for many of these people to deal with, so they keep going on, even though there are striking contradictions, even though you can prove that there's an alternative source of redshift with the induced electric dipole redshift theory that's explained in my books in more detail. But imagine that one day these scientists had to face reality and look at this and say, you know, the data is very specific. The redshifts are due to internal properties of stars. The redshifts don't have anything to do with the movement of the stars the way they used to think they did. And the redshifts that are coming in from all these objects around the universe are not due to the motion of these objects away from us in an expanding universe, but are simply due to the electric fields that surround these stars. All of a sudden, the Big Bang theory goes away. All of a sudden, the concept that gravity is the only force in the solar system that matters goes away. The idea that comets are dirty snowballs goes away. And if you have comets coming into solar systems, some of the large ones forming planets, then the other axiom of astronomy that the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago all at one time, that goes away. Every theory, the basic structure of astronomy, would fold with the simple realization that space, outer space, is not electrically neutral. So let's talk about galactic evolution. And here's a case where gravity does the majority of the work. There are some ideas out there dealing with electrical concepts for galactic evolution, but in general, on a large scale, with massive objects that are forming in galactic environments, gravity is the majority of the force that works on forming and maintaining galactic orbits. So it's very interesting that even though there are electrical currents flowing through galaxies, it's not the major formative force that forms a galaxy because of the scale. And there again, you don't need 11 dimensions to understand this. You only need simple Newtonian physics. You only need an understanding of electromagnetism, because the galaxies do put out an electric field, but it's not as intense as the one that's around a star. It's not locally as intense. So, for example, our Sun is in the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, and we, in fact, our Sun, our solar system, discharges the capacitor of the Milky Way galaxy. But our orbit is mainly controlled by gravity. And you can work out the equations to understand exactly why this is, what force dominates under what conditions, and it turns out that any object larger than a baseball is not really affected greatly by electrical forces in outer space. So one might ask, well, how could a big planet-sized comet have its orbit altered? It's not due to the electric field that is part of the solar system or part of the comet. It's due to the fact that that electric field of the comet is drawing in large volumes of dust and matter, and that attraction of the nucleus towards the dust and matter coming in alters the nucleus orbit. And it's actually more effective for large comets, something that totally contradicts, once again, the dirty snowball comet model, which claimed that only small comet nuclei would be affected by what they call a jetting action. So at any rate, let's go on to another topic here, and I think this is a very important topic in the way nature works, whether it's a galaxy, whether it's a solar system, whether it's our planet, or whether it's a small storm on Earth, whether it's a cyclone, whether it's a tornado, or whether it's just an average afternoon thunderstorm. That is the fact, and we can observe this, like I say, in all of these different arenas, whether it's dealing with biological life or whether it's dealing with more abstract concepts like the motion of a galaxy or the motion of stars in a galactic structure, that natural disasters are a way for nature to clean up and renew the cycle of life. Let's put it that way. Now, let's take an example. Let's take an example of a hurricane coming through the Caribbean. It hits a Caribbean island, blows all of the trees down, causes a tremendous amount of rain. The rain erodes the mountainsides, which wash down the gullies and into the ocean. The animal life is depleted, and all of a sudden they come back and they start growing back, and they're under stressful conditions. So there's a modification in the structure of these animals. They have to adapt to more stringent conditions, and then as they become successful and the plant life grows back, they start to get larger and larger as future generations go on. A lot of people don't realize that even the pilgrims of just a few hundred years ago were much smaller people than we are today on average. They didn't have 360-pound guys that could be linemen on a football team matching with what we have today. They were smaller people. You go back to the Mayans back in the 800 AD era. The people there, the Mayans, were short. They were about 4 feet tall. And the Lacandon Indians in that area are a surviving element of the original Mayas, the classical period Mayas, Indians of Central and South America and Mexico, southern Mexico. But the point is that nature uses destructive forces to change, to alter, to renew. Take a comet coming through the solar system. It comes in, say, from the far reaches of the solar system. Possibly it's never been in our solar system before. It could be small, it could be medium, or it could be large. But let's take the case of a large planetary-sized object racing into our solar system, breaking the solar capacitor, becoming a large comet, and coming near the planets, electrical discharges, zapping the planetary surface, causing tremendous winds, the influx of hydrocarbons, the influx of water, causing tremendous flooding, or as in the case of Mars, actually extracting the atmosphere and oceans completely off the surface of the planet. These are extremely violent times for the planet, possibly causing complete extinction on the planet, as in the case of Mars, or mass extinctions, as was the case on Earth. and these events happening over and over again throughout the history of the planet. These are times when nature finds its own way. This is nature's way of renewing, of recycling, of changing. And it's also nature's way of not allowing species that do not understand the ways of nature, like man is right now. Man is heading down a road, definitely down the road towards destruction. And not, it is not because of nuclear war. It's not because we drive automobiles and pollute our atmosphere, because those are somewhat localized events, and actually those things could be cured and man could actually live through those. But the thing we potentially will never live through, eventually a large cometary object will come through the solar system and rattle the cages of Earth, possibly extracting off the atmosphere and ocean, just like it did with Mars. And remember, Mars is already rebuilding its atmosphere. Mars is, the atmosphere of Mars is twice as large as it was only 15 years ago. So planets do rebuild. But if man, for example, fails to understand that we only have a limited amount of time and we have a limited resource here, time being one of those resources, materials being one of those resources, and the time that we have with ingenuity and manufacturing capability. So instead of making more Christmas toys or making more SUVs or instead of making presents for the next holiday or whatever, if man does not change his direction and start building a space-faring capability, then he's doomed to extinction on this planet. And it may not happen this year. It may not happen this decade. It may not happen in the next 100 years. But if man continues down the road that he is on right now, he's guaranteed to be driven to extinction. And we know that happened in the past, where man was driven almost to the verge of extinction, but came out with enough people to rebuild the population. And we look around, all around us, and we see the remnants of these destroyed populations. But remember that in the complexity of man attempting to explain his past, he's made these convoluted arguments, like man coming across the Bering Straits to populate the Western Hemisphere. An absolutely ridiculous theory, but still being taught in the schools. The idea that man originated in southeastern or southwestern Asia, in the area that used to be called Mesopotamia, and that all of the variations, all of the races of man generated out of that one birthing place on our planet, it's absolutely ridiculous, because we know that the Chinese were well developed, that the India, the people from India, Tibet, Africa, the Western Hemisphere with the Mayan and Incas were all well-developed cultures a long time ago. There was a great disaster which drove these people almost to extinction, and these small population centers all over the world began to grow again. And then in, we'll say, Marco Polo was a time when the East met West, or when Columbus first came to the New World and discovered that there were people living in the New World already. You know, in 1492, he met people that were intelligent people living in the islands. And then as they went into Central and South America, there were huge, vast populations. Areas of Western Peru where hundreds of millions of people lived prior to the Egyptian pyramids. These are being dug up and talked about all over the world, but not in good old United States. You'll never hear about this because it contradicts the complex and distorted history that's been built into our Western way of thinking. And no way, no how, by any manner of thinking or by any imagination, will any of these stories be changed, because it is too ingrained. Possibly extremely slowly will these ideas be changed, but it certainly isn't happening now as I sit back and watch the educational process in this country, which I consider to be a complete and utter failure, lacking creativity or the ability to give students time to be creative or to go study the real history of man and the real history of our earth, and blocking out, creating textbooks that supposedly contain knowledge, not allowing the student to go out and study on their own and truly understand and research the teachings of everybody that might be teaching various material. And there is a lot of quacks and goofballs out there today, I admit that. And so there is a real need for peer review. But oddly enough, peer review has become the thing, in the sciences at least, that has kept any concept, any new concepts from coming into vogue. And I don't see peer review as being as heavy-handed in many of the other areas of study, like in mathematics, for example. I see these areas of study being advanced because there are people in charge of mathematics and other endeavors under other academic endeavors that understand that change is good. They get excited about new concepts coming in, but not in astronomy and astrophysics. Only the same standard stories can be promoted. That's the other thing. Mathematicians don't have a lot of money at stake in grants like the sciences do. Mathematicians work with their brain and with their pencil and a piece of paper and possibly computing, but they don't have the vast monetary resources of the astrophysics, space science, and astronomy communities. And so I think that's a big factor in the difference between these communities, just the type of people that are in them. What I'm saying is that in the development of science, because of the fact that money is involved, there's a lot of ego involved, and a lot of vested interest in certain topics, that they resist change. So back to the main topic that I was talking about, that natural disasters, forest fires, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, comets coming into the solar system and ravaging planets, all of these are nature's way of cleansing and starting anew, and not allowing any species that doesn't understand the ways of nature to get too far along down the road. So I believe that's very interesting. It's a very wonderful design in nature, and man on this earth is failing to understand that very simple principle. It's only the species that understand how nature works and then lives along with nature, only those species are going to survive in the long term. Because imagine, even if you, say, have warlike ways on Earth, and then you manage to get out into space for a little while, you're going to try and take all your warfare gear with you, and before you know it, there will be a solar system-wide disaster. So the point is, regarding the development of outer space and travel in outer space, sending your military out there is a very bad idea, because you simply don't have enough time, you don't have enough resources, physical resources and time resources, to put your military out in space and then go out in three dimensions with your military and then expect to fight other entities that you may find out there. Simply put, you will fail if that's your program. On to the next topic. Talking about something that is an offshoot of this idea of going into outer space, today man is still looking at chemical rockets to get items into outer space. There's a couple very basic principles. One is an electromagnetic propulsion system. That is the way to move in outer space. And another one is aerodynamic lift. something that, for example, Bert Rutan used when he built the Spaceship One. How to get your spaceship up that first 4 or 5 or 6 miles. So that's up to, 6 miles, 30,000 feet, or 8 miles, 40,000 feet. I believe the altitude that they dropped off the Spaceship One with the carrier Black Knight vehicle, is it the White Knight or the Black Knight? I can't remember. But Bert Rutan's carrier ship that they use for experimentation, the twin engine, jet engine carrier craft, at any rate, capable of carrying the Spaceship One up to an altitude of 50,000 feet. And look at the, you don't have this giant rocket. Now, here's the problem with a rocket. You cannot go over about 300-400 miles an hour in the low atmosphere because of the incredible amount of friction, resistance, air resistance. And so you have to go relatively slowly that first, oh, let's say 8 miles up, the first 40,000 feet or 50,000 feet. And after that, then you can give it a kick and start accelerating, because you have to get up to 17,000 plus miles an hour to be in low Earth orbit. So you have to go from about 300 or 400 miles an hour to 17,000 miles an hour after you get over that first dense atmospheric layer that surrounds Earth. But instead of using a rocket with huge amounts, huge volumes of fuel, you can do something intelligent. Very simple. You use aerodynamic lift, because the aerodynamic lift of an airplane wing gives you typically a 10-to-1 lift ratio. In other words, if you just had a flat wing and tried to make an airplane go, and the lift of the airplane was simply due to air hitting that flat wing and bouncing off and causing the airplane to go up, the difference between that and an aerodynamic wing, or the wing shape, the Venturi shape on the wing, is a 10-to-1 ratio. So you have just eliminated 10 times the amount of fuel that you would have to carry by using an aerodynamic wing as opposed to a huge volume of fuel. So obviously, going into space by the method that Rutan did, a runway to space, a runway to orbit type of technique, something I promoted for a long time, is obviously the way to go into space. Now, if you can couple this with electromagnetic propulsion systems, you have just solved the means, the mechanism for going into space, coming back from space, landing on Earth, and then also traveling out amongst the solar system, and then going to the stars, electromagnetic propulsion systems. So these are not anti-gravity, by the way. They simply are innovative designs, one of them, for example, pushing against the naturally occurring Earth's magnetic field, or naturally occurring magnetic fields out in outer space. The point is that there are very simple ways of doing things, going into space, maneuvering around outer space, coming back in, and building a giant rocket or an extremely heavy space shuttle is not the way to go. So to imagine that now we are strapped because we have a president that has no vision or understanding of outer space, it just amazes me that scientists blindly follow this ridiculous presidential directive to build another rocket system to go into space, when clearly anybody in science today would recognize the fact that rockets are not the way of the future. They will not get us into outer space. They're very cumbersome, and they're very limited, because you can only get so much weight or mass into space, even though you might build bigger and bigger rockets. I've talked about the rocket problem before in this show. The fact that as you add payload, the size of your rocket gets exponentially larger. So there's a point of no return on building large rockets. The Russian Energia and the American Saturn V rockets being good examples of about the limit, the upper limit of a useful rocket coming from Earth's surface and going into outer space. And really, when you look at it, you cannot put that much payload into outer space. So obviously making a large aerodynamic lift system to go into space is the solution. Adding electromagnetic propulsion to that is the solution. But nobody, at least in Tier 2 science, is allowed to talk about that or do anything about that. They're made to follow this presidential directive, which is just going to try and duplicate what they did in the 1960s, or allegedly did, regarding going to the moon. Build a chemical rocket, build some kind of a spacecraft, go land on the moon, and then think about going to Mars in another 20 years. There again, the time frame. We don't have time to wait around, because the Chinese, I guarantee you, are going to be farther along in their space program in understanding that they have to live in outer space. There again, the simplicity of an outer space program requires that you learn how to live autonomously in outer space. Grow your own food, recycle water, recycle air, be autonomous, not depend on bringing up supplies from Earth or taking garbage back from the space station as is being done by NASA. So clearly, even though we've had 30 to 40 years of experience in space, I would say very little, if anything, has really been learned regarding how to live in space, how to maneuver in space, how to keep men up there for long periods of time, and most especially, how to get large populations into outer space. Obviously, it's my belief that nature has provided very simple mechanisms for us to do everything. Our trip into space should be one that's very pleasant, not warlike, not bringing warlike concepts into space, and the spacecraft should be light, lightweight, and very maneuverable. But none of this is happening. If you look at the replica Apollo space capsules, they are very thick, and you don't need spacecraft built to that heavy standard, because the difference between outer space and, say, a half an atmosphere is not that much. Expandable, you see private companies putting up expandable and inflatable space stations, and obviously that is the way to go. Put something small in a capsule when you get it up there, then inflate it. And that would obviously be the way to go as far as building spacecraft. Once again, simplicity. So you find that just about everything in modern science is anti-simple. What we have to be doing is seeking simple solutions, following them, and that is the way we have to build science in the future. Once again, I am out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And just quickly, remember to go to my webpage or the 800 number, 800-983-5622. And order your Berkey water filter. I know you're going to need it. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.